Thank you very much for joining us here at the second Free the Truth event. This evening, we host Madame Eva Jolie, Mr. Niels Meltzer, Lisa Longstaff, and Craig Murray, who will be discussing torture, human rights, and the legal aspects of Julian Assange's case. Also with us today is Julian's father, John Shipton, who might come and say a few words. Over the years, WikiLeaks has provided a vast array of information that enables accountability, that enables whistleblowers to tell us about the crimes that governments commit in our name. Whether it is corruption in Kenya, Julius Baer's corruption, Guantanamo Bay procedures, Tibetan dissent, climate gate, Barclays Bank tax avoidance, Baghdad airstrikes, and the eponymous collateral damage video where two Reuters journalists were mowed down, amongst others. TTIP information, the Saudi cables, Trident, Australian bribery, NSA spying on the general public, the DNC papers, Saudi cables, all of this which has allowed us to hold our governments and corporations responsible for the actions they take in our name, has been made possible through the efforts of one man who had the vision to create a technological platform that allowed us to hear from those who knew the torture and rape of people all over the world, done by our government, was Julian Assange. Julian Assange is now in Belmarsh maximum security prison, being tortured ahead of a potential extradition to the US to face 175 years in an American prison. The person who revealed torture is being tortured, while those who committed the torture are roaming free. And it is this injustice that we stand together to condemn. I'd like to introduce our first speaker today, Craig Murray, who is a historian and a diplomat of 20 years. He's been an ambassador, our ambassador to Uzbekistan, he's been a whistleblower lifting the lid on state crimes. He's also been the rector at the University of Dundee between 2007 and 2010. Perhaps most interestingly for this audience today, he is a committed and generous supporter of Julian Assange, who will tell us about the broad outline of the case and the key issues we need to think about ahead of the extradition hearings in February and May. Craig.
Today I have to, because it's the feed for the recording. But apart from anything else, it obscures the magnificent beauty of my face, which would otherwise be beaming down upon you. Julian's case really is quite extraordinary. The fact that he is up for extradition to the United States on a charge of espionage for publishing the truth about war crimes is extraordinary. The fact that this is the most political charge you can imagine, by saying that political extradition in political cases is not possible, that is extraordinary. The whole raft of judicial exceptionalism. I can't find a precedent of anybody having been given as long a sentence as Julian was given for bail jumping. We saw that chap, Jack Shepherd, who actually killed somebody on the Thames, not deliberately, but killed somebody, who then ran away, and who eventually, on his return from Georgia, was given half the sentence that Julian was given. And that was someone who'd killed someone, as opposed to punishing something. We had, in the original Swedish extradition case, we had the Supreme Court ruling that Julian's extradition request from Sweden was valid, even though it didn't come from a judicial authority, because they preferred the French text of the extradition treaty to the English text. And while judicial authority in English did not include a prosecutor, in French it could include a prosecutor. And there's never ever been a legal example in English law of the foreign language version of a treaty being preferred to the English language version of a treaty. Judicial exceptionalism has been used at every stage of the process in the persecution of Julian Assange. Now, many of you here have heard me talk about Julian and his case many times. I was thinking today that I would like to talk from a slightly different perspective than I normally talk on the subject. And that's the perspective of a whistleblower. Julian government secrets. I am a whistleblower. I had a career of 21 years in the Foreign Office. 6 years of my career was in the senior management structure of the Foreign Office. And when I came across UK complicity in torture and extraordinary rendition, I decided, as a matter of conscience, that I couldn't go along with it. As the government were denying that extraordinary rendition existed, Jack Straw claimed to Parliament that extraordinary rendition was a conspiracy theory. As the government was denying the existence of extraordinary rendition, I realised that I would have to produce actual evidence in order to get people to believe me, and I accordingly leaked a number of government documents. The first and most important of the government documents I leaked was actually published by the Financial Times. Now then, when I did that, I was well aware that I was taking the risk that if I was caught, I would go to prison. I was perfectly aware of that risk. My main tactic was not to get caught. But of course, if you are somebody like me who had been in government, who had access to top secret material, and who had decided as a matter of conscience that you could not keep the content of that top secret material secret because it revealed illegality, and complicity in torture is illegal in international law, of course you realise when you take that step you may go to jail. And I was prepared to go to jail, and I could paper my walls with letters from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office and from the Crown solicitors threatening to prosecute me under the Official Secrets Act, to which I always replied, please stop writing me letters. This is my address. I am at home if you wish to arrest me. And nothing ever actually happened. And the reason nothing happened, and I know this, more than 20 years working in an organisation without having a lot of friends in that organisation. The reason nothing happened was because of a man who we remember too seldom, who now lives in Scotland, who I'm happy to say I'm in contact with, and that's Clive Ponting. Now, if you remember Clive Ponting, he leaked the evidence that the Belgrano was sailing away from the Falklands, not towards the Falklands. At the time, it was sunk, and thousands of people were killed. And Clive Ponting was prosecuted under the Official Secrets Act. And there's no doubt whatsoever, and Clive will happily tell you, that he was guilty. He did it. He was guilty. But the jury refused to convict, because the jury system, 12 honest citizens, refused to send a man to prison for telling the truth about a war crime. And in my case, I know for sure, from eyewitness accounts, that Jack Straw decided that they could not prosecute me because they might get a Clive Ponting verdict. And that would make the Official Secrets Act still more of a dead letter. And it would also give even more publicity to their complicity in torture and extraordinary rendition. So I never was prosecuted. But think of this. What they're doing with Julian is the equivalent of if they had prosecuted the editor of the Financial Times, Lionel Barber, for having published what I leaked. And that is absolutely ridiculous. That will be the death of a free media if that is allowed to happen. Journalists do their job. I leaked further supporting material. I had meetings with a number of journalists over the next year or two. And journalists, I include, for example, David Lee, the deputy editor of The Guardian. Journalists were asking me if I had any more documents to reveal and encouraging me to reveal them, because that is the job of a journalist. And if Julian was doing that with Chelsea Manning, Julian was only doing the job of a journalist and no more. And it is dreadful that establishment evidence of the malice of the Times. You know, if I leaked today, it was 15 years ago now, I'm getting old, it was 15 years ago I leaked the intelligence material on torture and extraordinary rendition. If I did it today, they would prosecute. And I would be prosecuted in a secret court in which the public would not be admitted. And nobody would be allowed to report on the provisions of the court, on what happened in court, because it's a national security case. And there would not be a jury to acquit me. It would be held before just a judge, because it's a national security case. Because the freedom this country used to enjoy, the freedom that allowed Clive Ponting to stay a free man for having done a justified leak, that freedom has been destroyed by the increasing apparatus, security apparatus of the state, which has stripped away ancient freedoms in the name of the war against terrorism. We live in difficult and dangerous times. And we must see the attack on Julian Assange and the prosecution of Julian Assange in the light of the broader attack on civil liberties. That is why it is essential we all stand with Julian. It is essential this has fought tooth and nail through the courts. His extradition is stopped, and we try to hang on to a freedom fighter. We try to hang on to the right to publish material, and we try to hang on to the right for citizens to know about the lies and the crimes of governments. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig. Next, I'd like to introduce two people, John Shipton, and what your support today and your solidarity means to us.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. So many familiar faces here. I have to say friends or extended family behind me and in front that I've met over the years of this fight for Julian's freedom. I'd just like to make two points. One is that the institution of a policy of judicial abduction, what they call extradition, is a policy, and it's been put in place over the last 10 years by the United States rewriting the extradition laws with any country that would accede to their requests. My country, Australia, has simplified extradition to the United States. It parallels a policy of extrajudicial murder, as we saw the other day in Iraq when seven men were obliterated by hellfire. And just 2 days ago, seven children in Afghanistan. Policy, policy, policy. They're not accidents. The intimidation that weighs upon all journalists, all publishers, and all publications after witnessing the persecution and, to quote Mills, the slow murder of Julian Assange means that we won't get any insights into government. We won't have verifiable factual information about our decisions and whether to support these programs or manifest against them. So the other point I'd like to make is that Julian has never broken any law. Julian's punctilious about keeping laws. As you can see, over the last 10 years, he's fought bringing the laws of the countries concerned, the United Kingdom, Sweden, and international laws, human rights laws, to his side to defend himself, each of which have been abrogated. So he has made no breakage of laws. So incarcerated in Belmarsh maximum security prison for now 11 months, I think. Anyway, forgive me if I'm inaccurate on the time. Maximum security prison. In 22 hours a day, staring at the ceiling, unable to speak with lawyers, unable to have access to a decent computer to defend himself. This man has broken no laws. The extradition request signed off by the Minister for Justice must be cancelled. That's the first thing. The second thing is that I live here now and I rented a house. Julian's grandchildren live with me and their mum. His sister lives with me, who you just met. His brother is a British citizen. His nephew and cousins are British citizens. There is absolutely no reason justifiable under heaven, that Julian Assange not be given bail. So one, the extradition cancelled. Two, if not, if we can't get enough energies against the government, bail. I don't quite mean against the government. Energies to redirect their cancel the extradition and at home with his family. Thank you very much.
Julian Assange's case sets many precedents. It sets precedents in relation to the suppression of dissent. It sets precedents in relation to the extraterritorial reach of the US state, persecuting a non-US citizen for committing the crime of journalism outside of the US. It sets precedents for freedom of speech and the rights of whistleblowers. It also sets precedent for state-sponsored torture and the collusion of different states to attack one individual. Today we are gathered, of course, to discuss some of the legal aspects of the case. And in doing so, it is my pleasure to welcome someone who has given a lifetime to a vision of a fairer and more just society. She's a fraud prosecutor who nailed oil giant Elf Aquitaine when they were committing grossly inappropriate corrupt transactions. She's been someone with a commitment to green politics and sustainable development. She chaired the Development Committee of Parliament, of the European Parliament, the Development Committee of the European Parliament. She was a member of the Committee on Civil Liberties, Justice and Home Affairs. And she was also on the Delegation for Relationships with Afghanistan. And it is my great pleasure to introduce Madame Eva Joly.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for being here. Julian Assange must not be extradited, and only a very massive mobilization of ordinary people and also of people from the law community can stop it, because it has been programmed for years that he should be extradited. He should not be extradited, first of all, for legal reasons, because in order to be extradited, you need what we call double incrimination. It must be a crime in the two countries. And publishing information that is of public interest is not a crime here in the UK. There is no proof whatsoever that Julian has never ever penetrated the system of the American army. They don't have any proof of that. So they tried to get him extradited on charges of violation of Espionage Act, which is quite extraordinary. It is a violation of the double incrimination rule. That should not happen. And if we let that happen, that means that we will allow the United States to have extraterritorial competence, meaning that it is for the US to decide what is contrary to their security interest, and that we cannot have. We cannot have a position where they should decide what we can publish and not. And this is not a joke, because we have seen it in other areas. Today, they have a very powerful legislation, anti-corruption legislation. They call it the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And this law, or what the way they have interpreted it, and we have not resisted, is that as long as an American interest is involved, they feel they take the case, meaning that if you have a corruption case between Angola and US, and this has been a terrible weapon to weaken the European industry, and I'm very happy about prosecution for corruption, but when you look at the cases, you see also that it is a political tool. And we have not been able to withstand it. And it will be exactly the same thing. If we allow this to happen, that is the end of investigative journalism in Europe. And we cannot let that happen for our democracies, not to let this happen. There is another condition for extradition. That is to be sure that there will be a fair trial. And we are sure of the contrary. We are sure that there will be no fair trial. Because of the sayings of people, because of what Donald Trump has declared, but also Hillary Clinton. They have been very excessive in their declaration, saying that he merits for Donald Trump death penalties, and this has been very violent also in the Senate. So we know that he's hatred, and we know that he has been spied upon by the CIA when he was in the embassy, and that this spying has violated his fundamental rights, his right to privacy, and his right to have a private conversation with his lawyers, because they were also spied upon. But the most extraordinary thing is that the Spanish company who did the surveillance in the embassy, it was called UC Undercover Global, they had a direct link to Donald Trump. So this is not possible. It is not possible. And the situation has been very difficult for Assange since the beginning. I want to talk a little bit about that. It is because of Sweden. Because of the reputation of Sweden. Because as a member of the European Parliament, as a member of the Commission on the Liberté, I have participated in the inquiry on the secret prisons of the CIA in Europe. You know that they were in Poland, they were in Romania, where they practiced torture. And these secret flights, they stopped at Arlanda Airport. The Swedish allowed that to happen. I want to get back a little bit how I personally got to understand the situation of Assange, because I have kind of life principle in my life that you should do what you can for the people around you. And I happened to meet with Assange when he worked in Iceland, and I was working on the banking crisis, and he was working on a very interesting project that was to create a heaven for journalists, where there are no libel suits, no injunctions in Iceland. And we met to try to set that up. And that was in 2009. And when later I discovered that he was in the embassy. I thought that my duty was to go and see him and meet with him and see what I could do. And I came to understand that something was very wrong, because the Swedish prosecution authorities, and that was a woman called Marianne Nie, she pretended, and she even wrote on her blog, on her internet page, that it was not possible for her to go to London to interrogate, to conduct an interview with Assange. And as a judge and as investigating magistrate, I knew that that was totally bullshit, that this is a very ordinary thing. And I'm a very practical person, so I thought maybe, and I did, but she didn't want to meet with me, but I met with a lot of other people, and I met press conferences, and I said exactly this: this is not normal, it is easy to do, we do it every day, and that was a very strong signal that something was wrong. At that time, I didn't know, I hadn't decided yet in my head whether it was manipulation of the US authorities or whether she was. So my request at that time was that as the investigation was stuck, she should be taken off the investigation, as she has done this tremendous error, and the investigation should be taken over by somebody else. That didn't happen. Now we know why. We really know why. Grasa, due to the access to document law they had in Sweden, and to an Italian journalist, I think, who used it and got access to the file and found the interferences, found traces of calls with the FBI and extraordinary mails from this country, from the Crown Prosecution Service, saying, don't you dare get cold feet. This is not an ordinary extradition case. We have all the proofs. This is not an ordinary extradition case. This is a political case. They have worked on it for years. And they are about to succeed, because the political situation is very dangerous for Assange. Because Boris Johnson, he needs good support from the US. He wants a very good deal. And maybe Assange is part of the price, as he was in the Ecuadorian embassy, where they put up a deal. We don't know what that deal is, but there is a deal. So I want to say to the UK authorities, we are watching you. The international community is watching you. And if you dare extradite,
while we're on the, still on the point of the stitch-up in Sweden and the collusion of the CPS in torturing and prolonging the torture of a publisher, it gives me great pleasure to introduce somebody who has made very clear that rape or domestic violence against women is not acceptable. But the proceedings in Sweden were never about rape or domestic violence or justice for them. Lisa Longstaff is from Women Against Rape, which provides self-help support and legal advocacy and campaigns for justice and protection for survivors of sexual violence and domestic violence, including asylum seekers. As somebody who interacts with the criminal justice system on a regular basis, we thought it would be useful to get her perspectives on the case, and also given her long-standing association with calling out the poor practices in the persecution committed by the CPS. Waugh's work has resulted in several legal precedents and key changes in the law, including the criminalisation of rape in marriage and the first successful private prosecution for rape in England. Lisa, of course, is also from the Borough of Camden and has been very active with the women of King's Cross, the prostitutes of King's Cross, helping to protect them against violence. And so it gives me great pleasure to welcome Lisa Longstaff.
Thank you very much. Information about murder, rape, and torture in Iraq, Afghanistan, Bosnia, and elsewhere. Soon after the major leaks, including the collateral murder video, which films US soldiers murdering a large group of civilians, there appeared allegations of sexual offences against Julian Assange in Sweden. From 2010, we have pointed out the unusual zeal with which they pursued these allegations against Assange. They wanted all along to extradite him for WikiLeaks. We said that from day one. It's been unlike any other rape we've ever seen investigation. In the Assange case, justice has been perverted. On the one hand, the women were railroaded by prosecutors and their names given to the media and splashed all over the internet. As with every rape prosecution, the women are not in charge of the case. The state is. Swedish and British prosecutors are responsible for how these allegations were handled. Evidence emerged, as has been said, that the UK Crown Prosecution Service told Sweden not to drop the cases sooner. It was clearly politically motivated. And sometimes men have chosen to defend Assange by attacking women in general, making sexist remarks about rape and about women lying about rape. This is undermining Assange. It really doesn't help, because women are always listening for whether Assange is being defended by men who belittle the anti-rape movement. On the other hand, Julian Assange has been treated by the media as if he were guilty, though he's never even been charged. There's been a sustained witch hunt against him, which supported their key aim, extradition to the US. All allegations relating to sexual offences were dropped soon after the US made their extradition request and charged him. As survivors of rape have often stated, this is far from what usually happens when we report. Let me compare. Police are now making it even harder to report. You're supposed to report a rape online and wait to be contacted. They've neglected evidence. In 2018, the Metropolitan Police was sued for refusing to investigate serial rapist John Warboys, and that was upheld by the Supreme Court despite a £1 million legal appeal by the Metropolitan Police, backed by Theresa May. Wrong charges are often brought. In court, prosecutors aren't necessarily briefed properly. The evidence doesn't appear on time. Women increasingly are dropping out because your phone and social media are trawled to discredit you and pass to the defence. As a result of the media witch hunt which followed and enhanced the state defence of their bloody secrets, all whistleblowers and investigative journalists are now under attack. from Chelsea Manning to Snowden to Glenn Greenwald, perhaps to Craig Murray. We welcome the NUJ support for Assange. They've passed a resolution, but much more is needed. We agree with Niels Meltzer, the UN rapporteur on torture, who warns of the alarming implications of the witch hunt against Julian Assange, and who carefully documented the serious psychological damage from his enforced confinement and now imprisonment. We oppose torture. We oppose the death penalty. Rape and other sexual assault and other sexual allegations against Assange have been used to pursue a political agenda intent on hiding, actually, rape, torture and murder committed by the state. The people who want to torture him are defending rapists and murderers. Chelsea Manning blew the whistle on murder, rape and other sexual violence, including on women and children, by the US military in those countries. Chelsea has been detained in solitary since May last year, a month before Assange was arrested, and is being fined $1,000 a day for refusing to testify to a grand jury with no public against Julian Assange. She's one of the most principled people we know of, and we must do all in our power to get her freed too. Nobody is held to account when governments act illegally, nor when the criminal justice authorities flout the law. And they actually make great efforts to cover things up. We need whistleblowers, whether people are uncovering rape of adults or children by military, local governments, police, the church, neglecting care homes, or the untimely death of patients in hospitals. Margaret Oliver, a former detective constable, led Greater Manchester Police's investigation into sex crimes against children. She recently rape and senior police officers should be now prosecuted for gross misconduct that resulted in most offenders getting away with child rape. We've worked with Shirley Oaks Survivors Association, the largest self-organised group of survivors of organised paedophilia in the UK. Teachers and social workers who blew the whistle were got rid of. Senior police detectives who got too close to power in their investigations were transferred to other jobs. The same has happened over and again elsewhere. The rape conviction rate says it all, really. Less than 3% of reported rapes lead to a conviction, granting rapists almost complete impunity. So you can't tell us the UK government cares about rape. Beware of how governments ignore or cover up rape and then manipulate allegations of rape with questionable evidence. In 2004, we and Black Women's Rape Action Project wrote to all women MPs about the rape in the Iraq War committed by US-UK occupying forces. Not a single woman MP answered. This global government's witch hunt has turned many people against Assange. People have openly called him a rapist, as if even that justifies sending a man to prison for 175 years for leaking government information about crimes against Iraqis. We refuse to let women's fury at the injustices we face. This is about the freedom to report crimes by the state. It's nothing to do with justice for rape. And please use our stuff when you're tackling people on these issues. We have a long way to go to win this fight, but I can feel that the movement is growing. And it's time that we took it back and really won this once and for all in all our interests. Thank you.
The words Swiss lawyer and superstar in the same sentence. I wouldn't have believed it, except that we now do have somebody who is really the superstar in uncovering and documenting and meticulously reporting and recording the horrors that are being inflicted upon Julian Assange by our states. It is my pleasure to welcome Arbitrary Detention and Torture, Niels Meltzer.
Good evening. Yeah, and thank you for having me. 200 years ago, in this continent, and this island belongs to this continent, even today, despite all kinds of exits. 200 years ago, we decided we no longer want absolute governmental power. We no longer want rulers that can do with us whatever they want. We want state and government to be subject to the rule of law. And we got rid of those absolutist rulers and we created democracies and the separation of power. So now governmental power is divided in the judiciary, a legislative power, and a government, and they're supposed to control each other, to balance each other, the so-called system of checks and balances. And all of this is based on democratic legitimacy. That's the system, that's the theory. Now we have a small problem, the human factor. Humans are not by nature democratic. And, you know, you can see it in traffic. The lower the probability of sanctions, the higher the probability of slight oversteppings of lines and violations. I want this 200 years ago. And based on a very painful experience of centuries and centuries of absolutist rule, I am claiming that today we are at the critical point where we might fall back behind that line again, unwittingly. This type of system is prone to collusion, yeah? The courts, they talk with the ministers, and the ministers talk to the members of parliament, and it's party politics, and then they have the lobbies, and so it's all a big club, the so-called establishment. Yeah, don't worry, I'm not gonna lecture too long. I'm just gonna say, that's what this is about. We need a free press that actually holds government to account and makes sure that they're actually checking and balancing and they're not colluding and abusing the power. If the mainstream media no longer does that, it is logical that we will have other actors coming up and trying to inform the people, not just to entertain them, but to empower them so they can actually exercise their democratic control. So here stops my professor part with the lecture, but this is what this is about. This is the context, and this is what we're risking to lose when we're starting to imprison people who tell us the truth that is no longer told to us by the governments, that are no longer told to us by the press. I started investigating this case last April, and I expected this to be very short. I was quite reluctant to get into it. I was poisoned by the same narrative as everybody else. Assange, the rapist, the narcissist, the hacker, the spy. I thought I needed to go to prison, visit him with two medical doctors, independent experts, to be sure we have an objective assessment. And I wasn't expecting to find anything dramatic, and to return back to the office and basically go on to deal with real torture. What I found was very different. I found a man who had been hunted for a decade. I found documents that illustrated a profound corruption in the judicial system, the judicial system had actually been abused to persecute a man, to idea of copying the methods of WikiLeaks and actually inform the public about government and what they are doing with the tax money that is paid to them and the power that is delegated to them. And the deeper I got into this case, the more profoundly I was shocked at how Western democracies have lost their course. I'm not saying we don't have rule of law in Britain and in Sweden and in the US and all the other Western countries in cases that don't threaten establishment power. But as soon as that power is threatened, we do not have the rule of law. I investigated this case, and sometimes I'm being told, well, you're overstepping the line, this has nothing to do with torture. I'm asking, how does it not have anything to do with torture when a man exposes evidence for war crimes and torture and rape, and no one is being prosecuted for that? How is that not a violation of the prohibition of torture? How is it not a violation of the prohibition of torture when someone is being hunted for years and exposed to intense, deliberate defamation, mobbing, and judicial persecution in order to intimidate the world of investigative journalism? Because intimidation, not interrogation, is the primary purpose of torture throughout the world. Torturers know very well that when they torture people, they might not get the truth. But they know where torture works always is when you want to intimidate people. Not only the victim, but everybody else. That's why women get raped on the village square, because everybody needs to be intimidated. That's the purpose of torture. That's the true face of torture. And that's what torture is about here, too. It's someone being publicly destroyed in front of our eyes, systematically and painfully. You can watch it in slow motion, to pass the message, if ever you dare to publish information that we declared secret, this is what's going to happen to you. And no one, not the special rapporteur, no one waited by states to report to states about their compliance with the prohibition of torture. I found in this case a violation. I reported it. I stuck to my procedures. But the states didn't do their job. They did not investigate. They refused to investigate. They refused even to engage in a dialogue with me, even to respond to the questions I am mandated by them to ask. But they say, I lost my impartiality. Am I supposed to be impartial between a torturer and a tortured? No. I'm supposed to be neutral and objective in investigating a case and not to have any presumption before I have actually investigated the case. But once I have found that someone has been tortured, of course I am not neutral. But I will defend the victim of torture. This case involves torture because Julian Assange has exposed torture, and it has not been prosecuted. And we're talking about war crimes, but he's been a man who has never killed anybody, who has never used violence on anybody. And in the International Criminal Tribunal of former Yugoslavia, the highest fixed term sentence was 45 years. 175 years. Plus 10 years of persecution. That's the first aspect. And his own abuse is the second aspect of torture. And obviously, what expects him there in the United States, we know it. And it's not just me. It's my predecessors. It's a host of human rights organizations, even human rights organizations like Amnesty International, that refuse to recognize that Julian Assange is a prisoner of conscience. Even they recognize that the prison conditions there are inherently inhumane and that, therefore, his extradition would be unlawful. So that's a clear bar to his extradition. What shocked me so profoundly, I expected when I write to Sweden or to Britain, I will get a response. Ukraine does not participate in or solicit or condone torture. However, when the UK Parliament reports in 2018 the Intelligence Security Committee that the UK has been involved much more systematically in CIA torture than was thought beforehand, and asked for a judicial inquiry, which they're obliged to do under the Convention Against Torture, and need to investigate and prosecute, the government refuses to do so. So it's not just about the case of Julian Assange. There seems to be a general policy of not investigating torture and ill treatment that has been conducted and perpetrated on the orders of the government. They wrote in a letter to me in 2018, I quote, "We take allegations of torture very seriously and investigate allegations against UK personnel," end of quote. But the UK government flatly refuses to even discuss torture findings that two independent medical doctors who are world-renowned, who have no interest in losing their credibility, their diagnosis, they don't want to discuss it with me, they don't want to. The Foreign Office claims, I quote, "Journalism is not a crime," and they have a high-profile campaign for press freedom, yet they detain a journalist, Europe's most prominent political prisoner, just a few miles from that conference, and his name is not even mentioned in that conference at all. And then the UK says in a letter to me, or no, in response to my press statement after my visit to Julian Assange, they say to the press, the UK has a close working relationship with UN bodies and supports the important work of the Special Rapporteur on Torture. End of quote. Yet, I'm still waiting for their response. More than 100 days after I sent an urgent appeal to the UK government because I was afraid for Julian Assange's life, 100 days later, I'm still waiting for them to even respond to my letter. How is that a close working relationship? Perhaps I should send them my address, because they went to see the independent and appointed directly by the Human Rights Council. But the ambassador in Geneva seems to have told her that she's not happy with the way I conduct my mandate in this case. Incidentally, I heard they also told my employer in Glasgow they were not too happy about how I conduct my mandate. Now, I refuse to be intimidated. I conduct the mandate that the United Nations has given to me, according to the best of my knowledge and my judgment. It is a violation of my independence to try to circumvent official procedures and to try to undermine my credibility and standing with the United Nations and my employer. And I will certainly not back down. I'm not fighting against the UK government, and certainly not against the UK people, but I'm fighting for the UK people and the provision of torture that they and their country stand for. When the Foreign Office, the UK, writes to me, the UK is committed to the rule of law, but no branch of government seems to see any problem with Assange's most basic right being violated, namely his right even to prepare his defense. Then where's the credibility? Then I say to the Foreign Office, as I've said before, it is high time to quit talking the talk and to start walking the walk. It is also high time for the UK people to take the democratic means at their disposal and to hold the governments to account, and to use their institutions to do so. We thought it was a good idea to organize tomorrow an event at Chatham House, which is the Royal Institute of International Affairs. The event was booked, and paid for, I'm told. But suddenly, it was cancelled by Chatham House. And I thought, isn't that striking? In the website speaks of 100 years of independent thinking. They're afraid, and they now have, not the Swedes, the Swedes already have got cold feet, but now they have cold feet as well. And luckily, Frontline Club has picked up the slack of independent thinking and will have their event there tomorrow. The Foreign Office, Chatham House, BBC. It's more than 9 months I'm trying to have an interview with BBC and to see how they disagree with my assessment. I propose to have a heart-to-talk interview with them. They feel it's not newsworthy. As we have seen a recent interview with Joe Correa by BBC, they still adhere to the version and to the narrative that Julian Assange evaded justice. Some of you who follow me on Twitter may have seen how I reacted to that. That in 1940, Hannah Arendt was arrested by the Gestapo for anti-state propaganda. She was interned by the Vichy regime and then succeeded to escape to the US, where she got asylum. Did she evade justice? Did Cardinal Joseph Minzenti, in 1956, when the Soviets invaded Hungary and he escaped to the US embassy, where he spent 15 years in hiding until his safe passage could finally be guaranteed, did he evade justice? Did Fang Rizhi, in 1989, who was at the top of China's wanted list for inciting the Tiananmen protests, he sought asylum in the US Embassy in Beijing? Did he evade justice? From the perspective of China, he did. I mentioned Moses Kushaba Rovreko from Uganda, who sought and received asylum in the US in 2009 when his native Uganda debated passing a bill allowing the death penalty or life imprisonment for homosexuality. Did he evade justice? Or even Najibullah, not everybody may agree with him. He cooperated with the Soviet occupation of a refuge in the UN headquarters in Kabul, where he stayed until 1996, when the Taliban pulled him out, tortured him, and hung him from a lamppost in the streets for everybody to see. You think his hiding was evading justice? So how, what's the difference to Julian Assange, who's seeking asylum in Ecuador, from a judiciary that has proven for a decade that it's not pursuing the law, but it is pursuing the freedom of press? How is that different? Where we know that if he gets extradited to the US, he will be convicted for inhumane conditions. Is this evading justice? How far have we sunk? If we prosecute people that expose war crimes for exposing war crimes, how far have we sunk when we no longer prosecute our own war criminals because we identify more with them than we identify with their people that actually expose these crimes? What does that tell about us and about our governments? Like Chelsea Manning, and first sentence of 35 years in prison. Again, compare it to the war criminals in The Hague that are sentenced to 40 years for genocide. How far have we sunk when telling the truth becomes a crime? It's urgent. I'm glad to see you here, but what hurts me are the empty seats. It's really urgent. We need to, and we have to wake people up. Thank you.
We have gathered here today, some of you are lawyers, some of you are journalists, some of you are trade unionists, people from all corners of the world, people of different nationalities, people with different professional backgrounds, even children. And we are here to condemn four things. The involvement of the UK government in the long-term severe psychological torture of Julian Assange, investigations, and the inordinate protraction of Julian's detention, the disregard for international law and Julian's rights to privacy, the denial of medical treatment while he was at the embassy, the conditions of his detention, the conditions of his removal from detention, and the conditions subsequently in Belmarsh prison, the complete and utter disregard for Julian's right to a fair trial and the protection of his private life, and of course, the US extraterritorial reach. We're also here to condemn the disregard shown by the British towards their duties and responsibilities, the British government towards their duties and responsibilities under international law, including respecting the sanctity of asylum and the rights of Julian as a refugee. We are here to condemn the disregard by the British state for Julian's right to freedom of speech. We are here to condemn the severe and serious and extraordinary claims being made by the US, who are seeking to prosecute in the US, under US law, without First Amendment protections, a non-US citizen for conduct outside the US. We are here to condemn the suppression of whistleblowing and dissent. And in this, I'm very grateful to our four eminent speakers, Craig Murray, Lisa Longstaff, Niels Meltzer, and Ip, who stood in the rain and the cold and the wind outside the Ecuadorian embassy on the vigils, who stand outside Belmarsh, who go around Trafalgar Square handing out leaflets, who provide the support and the infrastructure needed by people like me to help organize events such as these. I urge you to support them. Emmy from the JADC is here. Before we take questions, Emmy's going to say a few words, but could I also draw to your attention that we have three professionally trained security staff given the nature of the event. We also have paid for the venue. I would be very grateful if you could make a small contribution of about £5, if you can, towards the venue hire, etc. And of course, we try to make these events free at the door, so we would be very grateful for a little bit more if you're able to. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Emmy Batlin, and myself and my colleagues at the Committee to Defend Julian Assange have been assisting the organisation of this event tonight. I would like to thank all the volunteers who have given their time and resources to help this happen, but primarily we're here for the same reason, to be inspired by the words that we have heard tonight by this excellent panel of speakers. And to thank them with all our heart for inspiring our determination to continue in the defence of Julian Assange in the streets of London, outside Belmarsh, outside the Home Office, in Trafalgar Square, and at every venue and platform available. Each and every one of us, using their own resources, their own creativity, doing what they can, no more, no less. He deserves the support of the public to hold in this country. He's a human being, he's a father, he's a son. He deserves our support. He's one of us. Thank you very much. On a practical level, I would like to invite everyone to tomorrow's event, organized by the official Don't Extradite Assange campaign, Press Freedom and the Case of Julian Assange, at 7 p.m. on the 4th of February at the Royal National Hotel Bloomsbury, London, WC1H ODJ, DG. A number of speakers, including Christine Krafenson, John McDonnell, Jen Robinson, Tarek Ali, and Nils Meltzer, will be speaking in defense of Julian Assange. Please support this event. I know it's only tomorrow, but please support this event. It's going to be fantastic. We have organizing a number of other events almost every day or every other day this month. If you wish to be informed about our upcoming actions, please leave your email address at the desk at the entrance. And with that, thank you very much, and we'll start the Q&A. I've been asked, and thank you very much for reminding me, the extradition court hearing dates are as follows. On the 19th of February at Westminster Magistrates Court at 9 and 10am will be an administrative case hearing, followed by a full extradition hearing at Belmarsh Magistrates Court inside Woolwich Crown Court, right next to Belmarsh Prison. Please, please support the protests outside, support by going to the courts and witnessing the events as they develop, and alert the public about what you witness. Thank you very much.
Questions from the audience. Let me bring the mic over.
There's a second mic here. Someone want to carry this around?
It's just in reference to the tragic case of Harry Dunn and family, and the extradition, or rather the refusal of the United States to bring the family or the lady concerned back to the UK. So if that were never to happen, would that help the case of Julian Assange? As in, they don't extradite, and would that help us then to help him not be extradited?
Thank you for that question. I'm going to direct that question to Craig, if I may, because I know he's written about the Sakoulis case before. So, if you'd like to say a few words.
Grab that mic there. Yeah. Yeah. Well, the first thing to say, of course, is that the Harry Dunn case is an important case in itself, and that Anne Sakoulis never had diplomatic immunity, and her husband has never had diplomatic immunity. Diplomatic immunity under the Vienna Convention is reserved to diplomatic agents. And in particular, the Vienna Convention specifically states that the families, immunity for family members of diplomatic agents only applies to those holding diplomatic rank. That's third secretary, second secretary, first secretary, councillor, minister, ambassador, in some cases attaché, none of which Mr. Sakoulis was. He was an intelligence agent, not based at any embassy. And it's simply a lie that the UK government in law designated this RAF station as part of the American embassy. That's simply untrue. And remember, you have international law in the Vienna Convention, but it only carries force when it's entered into UK law by the UK domestic legislation, and the UK domestic legislation empowering the Foreign Secretary to grant diplomatic immunity specifically and only refers to diplomatic immunity under the Vienna Convention. You can't have a side agreement with intelligence agents to which the Vienna Convention doesn't apply, to which the Foreign Secretary is entitled to give diplomatic immunity. And I am absolutely fed up with the Foreign Office, who lied and said she had diplomatic immunity when they knew very well it wasn't true, because her husband is not a diplomatic agent of diplomatic rank, so his family cannot have diplomatic immunity. Then they have been pretending ever since that they're trying to get him back and crying crocodile tears. And it's a complete charade. Dominic Raab contrived at getting her out of the country. Now they're only pretending to get it back. So I am absolutely fed up on the Harry Dunn case. I think it's another example of the complete ignoring of the rule of law, because there was no domestic legislation under which they were entitled to grant her immunity. That's why I actually think we shouldn't make any equivalence between the two cases, because once you make an equivalence to the case, you're basically saying, well, if you send us Anastasopoulos, we'll send you Julian Assange, which would, of course, be a completely immoral position. The Harry Dunn tragic case and the false granting of diplomatic immunity to Anastasopoulos is a terrible tragedy with the death of Harry Dunn in itself. It's a terrible abuse of governmental power in allowing this woman out of the country, and it's nothing at all to do with the case of Julian Assange. We should keep the two absolutely separate.
The gentleman in front here, please. There's a mic making its way to you.
Today in The Guardian, Mr. Greenslade, Roy Greenslade, I think, has said he supports Assange. He said he has spoken to other newspaper editors, and though they express some unhappiness, they seem to support Assange. One of them, of the Daily Express, has said he shouldn't be extradited. And this man says he's, Mr. Greenslade of The Guardian, is thinking of, hopes to get other newspaper editors to get together and agree that Assange shouldn't be extradited. Does any of the speakers have any thoughts about this in any way in which we can use this?
Very grateful that The Guardian has stopped, well, it still continues to slander him, but at least express some love.
What to say about bloody times. I think The Guardian has treated him appallingly. They have been one of the perpetrators of a lot of the lies, and it's about bloody time that they spoke up for him. And I hope that that chap Greenslade is now organising some defence among other journalists, and that would be a very useful thing to do. But it's a bit late, frankly. We should have been doing this a couple of years ago, but I'm glad they're doing it now.
Yeah. It is indeed very convenient for them to do it now. Could I have questions about Julian Assange's case only, please? Any other questions? Yes? Yes? If you just wait there, that's 1 second, we'll get a mic to you.
Okay. So it's extremely difficult to find this case because it's a matter of warfare, it's a matter of class warfare. And when you've got class warfare, you have to think asymmetrical warfare, right? So, Assange exposed war crimes. He's incarcerated. He's charged, the war crime criminals are let off. Now, what we need to do, apart from every other aspect, which, you know, which are blessed. Okay, but do the other thing as well. Show just how much we have been involved, and the United States has been involved in war crimes through the years. Like, while the Nuremberg trials were ongoing, starvation. The question is. Here, I'll put a question after putting a few facts.
Just the question, please.
Okay. 9 million Germans died under the starvation program after the war was finished. How many people know that? Virtually no one. Crimes and Mercies, the Fate of German Civilians under Allied Occupation. Check out. The question is, are the panel aware of these issues?
Thank you.
And if so, do they think they're relevant?
Thank you.
Because I do.
I would like to ask the panel and the people who know the conditions of Julian Assange. How is the conditions? If Julian Assange has been allowed to socialize a little bit more, because the prisoners were going to make a revolt in this government to socialize, then I would like to know if he is now able to socialize. Also, I would like to know if he has been allowed to have a good computer, not a broken computer, to defend himself. I would like to know if he has been given the right to have the proper papers, his knowledge that they stole from the embassy of Ecuador, if he has been allowed to have these papers back to defend himself. To his legal team is enough time, and also I would like to know how many hours he is in isolation, and how it can be possible if we can sue the government for all the cruelty and all the gross violation of the human rights of Julian Assange. Can we sue the government? Thank you.
Julian's conditions, unfortunately, had to take his little girl home. So if you don't mind, we'll park those questions and answer them through the Defence Committee's newsletter so that people can be aware. Could I take the next few questions? One at the back and the gentleman in the front.
Hi, hello. I just wondered, was there any pressure from the Australian government
to the UK or the US, and if so, is it significant? Could you repeat your question, please, because I don't think it's valuable.
Has the Australian government taken action in support of Julian Assange, and what would that be?
We are aware that a cross-party parliamentary committee has been formed, comprised by 30 different members of parliament, Australian parliament, and we are aware that on the 16th of February, two members of parliament will be visiting Julian Assange inside the Belmarsh prison. But obviously, for many years, Australia has been complicit by its silence. So, yes.
Thanks. Sorry, did you ask a question?
Yes, My name is Garland Nixon. I'm a journalist from Washington, D.C. And I'm wondering about the timeline on the trial. Of course, we're about to have, we're, you know, in the midst of an election cycle, and I'm wondering how you see things playing out as far as how far this can, how long this is going to take potentially with appeals or whatever, and how that will align with what's going on in the United States.
Well, I'm not an expert on extradition law, but these cases can take years with appeals. Potentially, you know, we could all be here in a year's time, and I think it'll still be going ahead if the appeal is first granted, if the extradition is granted, and then we go to appeal. The authorities, of course, have an incentive to fast track it because the authorities are exceptionally keen to extradite Julian Assange. So it's possible that we'll be into some kind of appeal process where the courts suddenly find they have time when they wouldn't in another case. But potentially it could last quite a while. I must confess, I think it's no secret in the real world that there's quite a gulf between Donald Trump personally and his security services. And I retain a hope that we may one day see a presidential intervention in order to stop this farce. I don't think this extradition is being driven from the White House particularly. You know, we have a presidential election coming up. We must all hope and work towards a refusal of the extradition at the first phase in Westminster Magistrate. I think that's extremely unlikely. I don't believe for one moment that the magistrate is acting as an independent judge. I think she's merely a product of the establishment. So I should be quite shocked if that. I should be delighted, but I should be very surprised, and my I'd be doubting my own judgment almost if that happened, because I really can't see that magistrate standing up to the powers that be and dismissing this ludicrous extradition. If we are into a second, if Trump were to be re-elected, then whether at that stage a president who's got his re-election done might be able to intervene in the process, I don't know. If Trump were not re-elected, I don't think the American presidential cycle is changing to a Democratic president. You know, we're looking at unknowns. If it's Bernie Sanders, maybe we will see a much greater emphasis on freedom of press. If it's Joe Biden, I doubt anything much would change. So we don't know. But do I think the process is liable to last beyond the next American presidential election, so a change in American politics of one kind or another might affect the process? Yes, I think that's quite likely. But I no more have a crystal ball than you have, and everyone here's thoughts on the subject
I think I don't think that the change in the presidency would really change, because he's also very hated by the Democrats. And I remember what Diane, the secret prisons, for instance, but I cannot quote her, but it was really very, very harsh. So I think our only hope is that the judiciary should do their job and not allow the extradition. And you know, in extradition, it is a state matter. The judiciary are giving an opinion, but they are not, the states are not going, if they say no, they never dare doing the extradition. So I think we have to fight for the judiciary, for them to say no, because that is what the law says they should do. And we should not change that practice. This is very well established. So I don't know what you think, Nils, about this.
I just want to add that what they do depends on what we do. The more power that we can grow among grassroots people and people in power who pay attention to what grassroots people are demanding, the more likely it is that we win justice. On the question of journalists, as it has been the media who has who has smeared Julian Assange all along, it's important that we get journalists to write the truth. And it hasn't been publicised, but the National Union of Journalists has passed a resolution before Christmas that they will get the truth about Assange out and stop witch hunting him. Sorry, it doesn't say stop witch hunting him, but it does say that they will support his case against extradition. And we have to hold them to that. So if you see stuff that's written by journalists, please call them to account and get better journalists who are, you know, the more radical ones to write more articles so that the truth gets out there. And the last thing is about the question of whether he's allowed to socialise. We have to commend the prisoners who campaigned for him to be out of isolation. To get out of isolation. If they can do that, then what can we all do?
Lisa, could I also draw to your attention the Doctors for Assange letter, which clearly points out that we do not know the long-term effects of prolonged physical, psychological, and other torture. And so it is not okay to use Julian as a guinea pig while we work out these various constitutional and other problems. This is a man whose life is at stake, whose life is in grave danger, and we need to take action now. We can't wait for appeals processes to make their way and for us to hope for the generosity of Donald Trump or indeed anybody else. Thank you. I've got two questions. There is somebody waiting there. Yes? And then next one.
This is really addressed to Nils Melzer. Thank you. I mean, just thank you, because obviously the impetus for preventing this injustice about Julian is going to come from powerful sources, rather, whether they're from the grassroots or from governments. And I just hope that you know that we're so grateful for you. What I want to ask you is, you mentioned Hannah Arendt and Fendi Siv and Moses Kushaba, and I was wondering if there's anything we can do in this instance that's different to what's been done before that might help change things.
Been very deeply, profoundly disillusioned in the last year about the integrity of governments. I hesitate to say how profoundly I'm disillusioned. I think it's far beyond this case. This case just gives us insight at how bad things really are. But that's also a reason to involve people and inform them and tell them, look, this is not just about Julian Assange. It is, yes, but even if you don't like him, it is about you. It's about your children. It's about whether they are going to have a future where they can still read the truth somewhere, or where everybody who speaks the truth will immediately be muzzled and imprisoned. I know Julian Assange has been moved out of isolation, and I'm very grateful for that. I happen not to be so enthusiastic about the motivations that may have led to that. I'm not convinced that a government that doesn't listen to the United Nations listens to inmates that are making petitions. I commend the inmates and their solidarity and integrity. But unfortunately, I fear that this was more a measure of preparation, because the hearings are about to start, and if you have someone who has been in a medical division of a prison for months, it's easy for him to argue, I cannot stand trial. So there may be a different, much more sinister motivation behind this. It's a speculation, but let us be cautious. I think, as dark as things may be, as I always say, in the darkest room, one candle is enough for everyone to see. Yeah? So this are switched on the light. On Julian Assange's case, but also in general, look and make people see, because it is their reality. People don't want to see the truth sometimes, but they need to see it, because otherwise we will all pay a heavy price. I think your function is that, where you are in everyday functions, switch on the light.
Of how many people want to ask any more questions. Mohammed, the lady in red, a second question there, and at the back. I will take solidarity. There are two people who wish to suggest other solidarity events that are taking place for unrelated to the Assange case, and I will give you an opportunity to mention them at the end if you don't mind, but let's focus on the Assange case for the moment. So if your question is unrelated to the case, could we park it just for a few minutes? Mohammed next. Thank you.
Mohammed Elmazi. I'm a journalist and contributor to The Canary and also Sputnik International, among others. The Council of Europe passed a resolution last week in which about media freedom, and in one section it explicitly stated that Julian Assange's extradition to the United States must be barred, and he must be released promptly. So that's a quote. To what extent is this resolution more influential politically, and to what extent does it have any sort of legal ramifications or influence whatsoever?
Yes.
Basically, it's not a binding resolution, right? It's the Parliamentary Assembly. But I do think that it's very important politically, because that's quite a change of tone from what we've seen, 6 months ago. And so we've seen public interest picking up, and even in Parliament, going beyond the left party into political figures like Sigmar Gabriel, who was Angela Merkel's vice chancellor and foreign minister. Him speaking out in favor of Assange and preventing his extradition and understanding the implications of this. So I think there we see momentum developing. And so in that context, I think this resolution is very important, because that draws attention and invites people that perhaps before were more reluctant, like myself a year ago, to get into this case, to actually take a closer look.
Thank you.
the resolutions that the parliaments are making, it's a political statement, meaning that I think there are 40 or something in the Council of Europe, that the people that are represented here take a position in favor. And I think this is the first time the European Parliament has not taken a position in favor of Julian Assange yet, but maybe now it's time to try. But they're not binding for anybody.
Thanks, Ava. Thank you. The lady over there. Did you have a question?
No.
Okay, thank you. Can I take the gentleman there and I'll come back to you? Yes?
I think Julian Assange is an international case because WikiLeaks has helped people everywhere in the world by what they said. Support in other countries for Julian Assange on the one hand, and particularly Madame Jolie, since you know, are in many places in Europe, if you know anything, I would be glad to hear. And also I wonder if on the 24th of February, that day of protests, we should be in great number in London, but we should also be in great number in New York, in Berlin, in Madrid, in Aten, in everywhere, and I wonder if we should really try to make an international call for this kind of international day of action. It was very effective in the case of Chelsea Manning. There's been a few of them, and that was part of the reason Manning was eventually free. That was not the only reason, but that was certainly a good reason.
With regards to, may I answer the question with regards to Global Day of Action? It has been called by the official Don't Extradite Assange campaign, and Alex Hills in New Zealand is coordinating that. It's going to happen. Thank you.
I made a test 2 weeks ago. I wrote an article about Assange. And very often, my articles are easy to get published. It was published in Le Monde easily. They took it in Aftenposten in Oslo, but that generated the debate. The chief editor was furious because she felt that I had put the journalists on stage saying that they had benefited from the information Assange had given them, making many reports, and they had let him go, and they didn't agree, and then we looked it up, and they had made, I think, 14 articles in 3 years, nothing. It was impossible to get it published in Sweden, impossible. I tried in all the newspapers, even the second tone in Göteborg. It was impossible here. It was impossible here. Nobody wanted it. So looks like here it is very touchy. In Sweden, they really don't want to hear about it because the idea that Swedish, they just don't want the French arm, maybe the Swiss, Germany, maybe some Nordic countries, but for Sweden. To answer your question, I think it is not yet there, but that is what we are working on, changing the public opinion by getting the truth out.
Three more questions, and then I will go to the two solidarity comments, one from the lady up front and one from the gentleman around the side. Yes, so could we start with the lady in the golden jacket?
Right. I wonder if the panel would agree that part of the problem is a failure of the modern day left of succumbing to sound bites and knee-jerk reactions based on political correction. In other words, sort of understanding the rules of progressive thought and not the underlying principles. Because in the beginning, Julian Assange had a large grassroots support amongst the left, and a lot of that has dwindled away just because of cheap memes based on ideas of rape and ideas of, well, you know what they are. But would the panel agree that actually what we've been losing is a sort of battle of the memes, in that what we've got left now supporting Julian Assange seems to be a sort of relative handful of intellectual thought, whereas we're losing the larger base of the left who have been misguided by these fake memes such as Julian Assange is a rapist? And shouldn't the challenge be to counter these memes and these sound bites, but to present it in a way that will get the word out?
Could I have a question for you, second?
Yes, we should. That's a good point, and I think it's important that all of us challenge misinformation, witch hunt information, and yeah, we just have to take them on, all of them.
Thank you. Go on. Did you want? Sorry.
I did. Yeah.
Please, go on.
We also have to recognize that we all have a tendency to seek comfort, to be lazy. Let me say it clear. Again, picture yourself in a dark room. Someone has a flashlight, points into a corner. Where will you look? You look where the flashlight's pointing. You will ignore the rest of the room. You will not look into the dark corners because you don't see anything. And so that's the cinema effect, right? Wherever the spotlight's pointing, everyone's just looking at that. And that's the function of the media. They are the spotlight. They're telling us where to look with the headlines and, whatever they put in the news and what they don't put in the news. But we have to question that. We have to know the room is much bigger and there's lots of dark corners there. The only way to miss an elephant in the room is just to always look at the spotlight, yeah? And if the elephant has the spotlight, you will never see it. Yeah? And so what Julian Assange and WikiLeaks have done, and other whistleblowers obviously always do, they take the spotlight and point it at the elephant. And then the elephant has this kind of gear reflex, you see? And then they quickly, within weeks, they turned it around and said, rapist. And then everybody looks at him again. And since then, everybody is debating rape and skateboards and cats and excrements on the wall and all these types of things. But no one, or whether he's wearing shorts while he's giving video conferences, the flashlight, right? So if we're not capable to actually question that and turn that flashlight, and it's obvious, we have collateral murder, it's there to see, it's sound and everything is there. And I can say that, having worked, as a legal advisor for the ICRC, having worked in war areas for 12 years, I know this is a war crime. I can see it. It's not maybe, perhaps it might be problematic. It's a war crime. You don't target and kill wounded people ever, even if they were combatants before. And you never target people that come to the rescue of wounded people, whether they have children with them or not. It's a war crime. It's not being prosecuted. It's not even dark. It's there. We know it. It's just no one's pointing the flashlight at it. So how, if we are tolerating that, and we're electing people that run office like that, and we're celebrating President Obama to be a human rights protector, and he has refused to prosecute torture. He has initiated this whole targeted killing programs. It's up to us in a democracy to decide who we want to govern the country. The evidence is there. And I think there we really have to take responsibility.
Thank you.
share my understanding that for a constitution to work, it is necessary for all members of the society to agree to take the responsibility for informing all their fellows when a crime is committed, and that in return for them observing this duty, that it is the solemn obligation of that society, under the principles of constitutionality, to protect those who are performing that duty against all those who dislike the idea that they have. And that without this, you can't have a constitution, you just have an old regime. And that this is the point, because under that, Julian Assange would simply, and didn't report it, would have been guilty of dereliction of that duty. And that that is the extent of the difference, and that we need to wake people up to the way that the constitution has been drained of its constitutionality. Just to add to something that Mr. Meltzer said, are the panel aware that in November last year, the BBC ran a programme, panorama programme, that proved that British forces had been guilty of many atrocities in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and that they had used the idea of ambulance chasing to cover this over, and that the government had behaved illegally, and so had the military, and nothing has been done. Are you aware of that?
Question from
Apfel.
Thank you.
Hi, we've just had 4 years of Brexit where the media and everybody who wanted Brexit have been shouting that we need to take back our sovereignty and we need to make sure that everybody's vote counts. Isn't this where the fight for sovereignty and democracy really is, and not the last 4 years of Brexit?
Comments from the people who've been waiting. But first, let me thank the panel for their time and their commitment to this cause. And thank you all for coming out of the meeting. So, the two solidarity speakers, I think there was one from the gentleman with the glasses and the lady in white at the front. Just here. Thank you. I beg your pardon, he's left. Okay. Maybe just the lady in white at the front. Yeah, that lady there. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. All I wanted to say is first, you know, I appreciate the brave activism of the speakers, you know, because you are a book that was published in 2018. It's called Show Trial. It's by an American academic called Thomas Dougherty. So in there he details the brutal, you know, suppression of people, you know, just-minded people in Hollywood, you know, in the late 40s. Okay? People know it as the McCarthyite era. So, you know, what I want to ask is history repeating itself in the form of show trials, you know, of those such as the trial of Julian Assange and my friend Aravindan Balakrishnan. You know, I want to ask you, is history repeating itself? Thank you.
Just say, I don't think we'll have an exact repetition of history, but it's more like a spiral, right? So we evolve, but we come back, and we have to face the same challenges again. But to be honest, I don't want to see our generation or the generation of our children to have to face the challenges of the Second World War and those attitudes with the technology of the 21st century. So I think there we should learn our lesson and perhaps, you know, react the way people should have reacted in the 30s.
The hall will be open for people to mingle and discuss other solidarity actions and other comments, so please feel free to stay for just a few minutes after the event. And Craig, you had one last comment to make.
On the point of show trials, I couldn't help feeling when I was last in Westminster Magistrates Court when Julian was there and when we were all sat behind a huge screen of bulletproof glass and he was away somewhere behind another, absolutely no genuine security reason for all of this, that this was simply a demonstration of the power of the state and that the whole thing is about terrifying other people into keeping secret the state's secrets. I think show trials have been used for that purpose for years and years, and I think it will go on. I'd like to make two more very quick points. The first one is I'm actually leaving here. I'm going to dash off quite quickly because I have a meeting with WikiLeaks about publishing some more secrets. So the work goes on. I think that's very, very important to say. I say that in the knowledge that MI5 follow me anyway, so there's really no... But the last thing is, you know, the Council of Europe decision was a very good statement and very strong by parliamentary representatives of all of Europe, from Russia all the way to Ireland, from east to west. And I do feel there is a swell of opinion. I used to get tremendous abuse every time I wrote something in favour or made a speech in favour of Julian. The online abuse I received was quite crushing on time. That has much lessened. People are gradually working out that this is actually about media freedom, slowly, slowly. And even The Guardian, which has been utterly disgraceful, now feels compelled to actually write editorials against the extradition. We are making progress. We are definitely making progress. And behind the scenes, progress is being made with politicians. You might be surprised to hear that progress is being made with. So I am actually reasonably optimistic that we, and the work everyone does at every level to try to influence and get that swing in opinion going is extremely important. So the work goes on. The fight for Julian goes on, and it is a winning fight.
Yes! Bravo! Bravo! Yes! Bravo! Yes!
Thank you all very much for your time.
Before you leave, and the chairman's given me permission to make this announcement, there's a human rights event, Human Rights in Palestine event, with film, presentation by visiting Palestinian students and lawyers, music song by a very talented singer, oud player and guitarist, Palestinian food, it's all free, there's no need to book.
Just waiting to get out.
At the BPP University, please make a mental note, BPP University, Stamford Street in Waterloo, Wednesday, the 5th of February, 7 p.m. Wednesday, the 5th of February, 7 p.m, BPP University.
Hi everyone, so I just wanted to come out of the, hopefully you can still hear me. The event's just wrapping up now, hopefully I'll get some interviews with some of the speakers. But I just wanted to go quickly and say thanks very much for all you saying thank you. I have one interview, I have two interviews actually in the bag that I'll be publishing this week, probably maybe one tomorrow, one the day after. And obviously cutting all segments from those, that will be happening over the coming week, and then I'll be setting up other interviews to do next week and the week after. And obviously the Assange trial starts on the 21st, the fourth week. I'll be doing all those, so I'll be up and down the country. Please, if you can, support me. The links are all below as to how you can, because obviously it's costly on trains, etc., going up and down the country and covering these dens. But I really appreciate all your support. I'm going to go now and hopefully get a word with some of the speakers. Yes, the 24th it is, Muriel. That's when the first week is, the first week of the trial. Okay, I'm going to go and get some, hopefully, a word with some of the speakers now, and I shall see you again tomorrow. I'll be dropping videos. Thanks very much for all your support. Please support independent media. It costs quite a bit to cover this stuff, and we can't do it without you. So thanks very much, and free Julian Assange. I shall see you again tomorrow.